Welcome to the Medical Journal of Australia podcast. The MJA is Australia's top peer-reviewed general medical journal, publishing groundbreaking research to the medical community since 1914. My name is Kate Swanell, and I am the MJA's news and online editor. For several years now, physicians caring for transgender children and adolescents have been crying out for a set of guidelines relevant to the Australian context. Now the wait is over. A team from the Royal Children's Hospital Melbourne and the Murdoch Children's Research Institute have published a new set of Australian Standards of Care and Treatment guidelines for trans and gender diverse children and adolescents. The full document is available on the RCH's website, just Google RCH Gender Service and you'll find them. Or if you prefer, the MJA has today published a guideline summary at mja.com.au. Lead author of both the guidelines and the summary is Associate Professor Michelle Telfer, who is Director of the RCH Gender Service. She joins me on the pod today. So there are new guidelines coming out for the treatment and care of transgender and gender diverse kids and teenagers. Why do we need those when there are international guidelines already?
Well, the international guidelines that have been published include the World Professional Association for Transgender Health and the Endocrine Society guidelines, both of which don't necessarily address all the issues that are relevant to Australian transgender children and adolescents. The WPATH guidelines are now quite out of date and were last published in 2011.
Which is an age in this business, isn't it?
It is a very long time ago. And although there are processes apparently in place to update this, they're not going to be ready in the near future. And the guidelines that were published back in 2011 aren't actually clinically as relevant anymore. We're not practicing, the entire world isn't necessarily practicing strictly within those guidelines because things have moved on. Endocrine guidelines, which are more up to date and were published last year, are really detailed in terms of endocrinology treatment, but don't go into the more general management of the mental health aspects of care, and also doesn't really look at the differences between how someone might approach this in primary care in terms of what GPs are expected to do,
yes,
and may wish to do, right up to mental health and other care within tertiary settings, for example. Neither of those guidelines really fit with what we do on an everyday basis in Australia. And also we have some very specific issues relevant to us, which have included legal restrictions on what we can and can't do. So recently changed and they've been updated with this guideline. Plus we have lots of trans young children and young people living in rural and remote areas. We have cultural and linguistic diversity that requires certain aspects of management to be adjusted to provide good care. And I think for us, we really wanted to have a guideline available that was really relevant to our clinical practice, and none of the others do that currently.
How many kids are we talking about?
The best studies we've got actually come from New Zealand, and their numbers suggest that the population of trans young people is approximately 1.2% of the population, which is a really quite large number. And 1.2% is consistent with other studies that have been done recently overseas. The New Zealand study is fantastic because it was done within the high school system across a large and variable demographic population, with more than 8,000 secondary school students asked a range of questions, with a couple of questions about being trans or gender diverse within that. So it's a good, reliable population with numbers that have been confirmed elsewhere. If we look at numbers of young people presenting to us wanting care, the numbers have increased substantially over the last 10 years. This is because of increased acceptance within the general community, as well as a marked increase in transgender visibility. A lot of people, as they come out and as we have celebrity culture where celebrities come out and talk about themselves or their children, it becomes much more acceptable. And as people feel safe in talking about their gender identity and their experiences, we've found these numbers of young people actually wanting to access care increasing. If For us, we had our first referral here in Melbourne at the Royal Children's Hospital in 2003. And within the first, between 2003 and 2007, we only had three referrals in total.
Wow.
Yeah, but last year we had 253 referrals within 12 months.
Wow.
And yes, we'll be
That's great,
heading
though.
Yeah, closer towards 300 in 2018.
What's the age range?
So we have children as young as three come with their parents who are distressed or not sure what to do when their child is expressing their thoughts that they're not the sex that they were assigned at birth. It's really interesting because people often say, oh, how can they know when they're that young? But if you ask any 2.5 or 3-year-old whether they're a boy or a girl, they will tell you in no uncertain terms how they feel about their gender. Only when they come out and tell us something that we don't expect that we sort of question, oh, how could they know, they're way too young. So we have 2.5-year-olds and 3-year-olds who verbalise very clearly how they feel innately about their gender, and we listen to that. Of course, we don't intervene necessarily because there's no reason to intervene at that young age, but what is very clear from the research that's coming out both in Australia and internationally is that if you support that child to express themselves freely and be who they are, their long-term outcomes in terms of mental health are very good and actually equivalent to the general population. Whereas if you try and suppress or discourage children and young people to express themselves freely and you actively not support them in doing so, we find rates of anxiety and depression that are very high. And in a study that was done across Australia in 2017, a study known as Trans Pathways, what they found was that 80% of young people under the age of 24 had self-harmed. And of the same trans population under the age of 24, 48% had attempted suicide.
Oh, that's grim.
Very grim. When we compare that to the population we're seeing in clinics where they're certainly supported enough for their parents to bring them in and often supported by both parents and enabled to transition as they desire, their mental health is so much better. Yeah, they're doing really well.
At what age does a kid start saying, well, okay, I feel different from what my assigned gender is, but at what age do they start saying, I want to do something about this?
Well, as young as 2.5 or 3, they might express themselves by saying, I don't want to wear that dress, I don't want to wear these pants and a shirt, I don't want to wear the school uniform dressed as a boy or a girl. In a social context, it can be really quite early, and parents often talk about arguments around haircuts, arguments about use of names and how they want to be referred. It's only when a child starts approaching puberty that they really worry about their physical aspects and wanting to change their body as such. You can imagine if you're a child who identifies as a boy, especially for those young people who are allowed to express themselves freely as a boy, the thought of growing breasts and not looking like a boy is terrifying. And the threat they feel around what they might experience in terms of stigma and discrimination escalates. So combined internal distress about their body plus the distress about how people may treat them differently will often really be heightened around onset of puberty. And that's where, as doctors, we can get involved and help with hormonal suppression to reduce that distress.
So if I'm a GP and my 9-year-old patient expresses these needs, what should I be doing as a first-line operator?
Well, we know that GPs are really important with these children and young people, and often the first experience that they have with the medical profession is with their GP, and we know that that is paramount to how they see the medical aspects of care and how keen they are to then freely express how they feel down the track. So we know that the GPs are really important, and especially when they disclose how they're feeling or the parents disclose how they're feeling. As a GP, I think the first thing to do is just to listen and to be comfortable in listening to how they may feel, not necessarily reacting in a particular way other than to allow people to talk about who they are and their sense of and who they are or who their child may be. And then to know that there are for children specialist services that can provide further care from there. So with a 9-year-old, and 9 is, at, as you point out, on the verge of commencement of puberty, I would be referring them to the specialist service in your state, and almost all states in Australia now have a specialist service that can you can be referred to, and then they'll start a full assessment in terms of mental health, medical, family, functioning, so forth.
My guest today is Associate Professor Michelle Telfer, Director of the Royal Children's Hospital Melbourne Gender Service. Her guideline summary of new Australian standards of care for trans and gender diverse children and adolescents is available now at nja.com.au. How has the legal landscape changed?
It's changed a lot, which has been for the better, in my opinion. so we still have some legal barriers, and they are outlined in the guides, standards of care and treatment guidelines that we've produced.
Yep.
The barriers now are around documentation of identity. So, for example, passports, Medicare cards, birth certificates and things. So there are those sorts of legal issues. But Australia, up until 2017, had laws in place that essentially prevented adolescents from accessing hormone treatment unless they had authorisation from the family court. And this is a situation that had been in place since 2004. Mm. And with the increasing numbers, as you can imagine, having hundreds of young people wanting to access this care but not being able to because of that legal process, there was a lot of distress. So following a number of years of advocacy with not only medical experts in this area but also with legal experts and, most importantly, I think, the trans community themselves, so trans young people and their parents, we were advocating for a number of years with politicians and the courts, and it culminated in a case last year. It was heard in September in the full court of the family court, and we had 5 judges in a court in Sydney, and essentially looking at what is the evidence for providing treatment in adolescence.
Yes.
For medical transition, and what is the role of the court in those medical decisions. And the case was handed down in November of last year, with the judgment really outlining that the court doesn't have a role to play in the decisions.
Brilliant.
For hormone treatment, except when there is a significant dispute between the parents or the parents and the medical staff. For most adolescents where they are competent to provide their own consent, they can access hormone treatment just as any adolescent can access treatment for other medical conditions at their age.
Right. My feeling from reading your guideline summary is that the biggest change is from following prescribed age limits for doing things and being much more individualised about how and when decisions are made about care, that is much more listening to the individual kids' needs and state of health.
That's absolutely right. And that's really what puts our guideline ahead of any that are available internationally, in that the World Professional Association had set age guidelines, really chronological age.
Yeah.
And the endocrine guidelines also specify an age, but do suggest that you may go outside of this. In reality, across the US and Europe, people haven't been sticking to chronological age for decades because everyone's very individual and everyone presents at a different age, has different circumstances. And we know that for some young people, delaying treatment can cause severe harm and harm to the extent that they may attempt or succeed with suicidal behaviour. So it was interesting. Recently, I was at a meeting in the US, and the Americans were presenting a history of these guidelines and looking at what needs to change.
Mm-hmm.
It was obviously before ours half had been published. It had been completed, but it hadn't been published as it is about to. And one of the Americans said, when is someone going to write a guideline that is relevant to what we do every day?
And, and I you put stuck my hand up again, yes.
Yeah, I said, well, actually, in Australia, we have a guideline that is affirming and is individualised.
Brilliant.
And that brought a lot of interest at this meeting. And
right.
Yeah, and we've had some really positive feedback, not just from colleagues in the US, but a consumer group in the UK have called for a similar guideline to be adopted by the NHS. And they were positive about ours, one, because we involved the trans community, children and their parents in,
yep.
in writing the guideline, and that it was affirming and really emphasised the need to listen to these young people and to respond to what they needed.
You mentioned earlier that there's been a real increase in awareness and visibility about queer and trans issues. I mean, we've got same-sex marriage now in Australia. From within that queer community, it can feel like everything's a lot better now. Is it sunshine and happiness all the way, or are there still problems that need to be addressed? Are there still doctors, for example, who are like refusing care or making life
yes,
difficult?
Absolutely. I think we have a very long way to go. We, as you know, we have a service and have produced this guideline that is affirming, but we know that trans people experience stigma, discrimination, abuse, harassment on a daily basis. And the results from that survey from last year were frightening, of these really high attempted suicide rates and self-harm rates. But even for the young people who are really comfortable with themselves, who are well supported by their families, who are doing well at school and have lots of opportunity, they continue to tell us about negative experiences that they have, whether that from people not understanding at school or new teachers that come along or someone on the tram or the train. It does really seem to be constant or persistent experiences that are negative for them. And it's, I think we have a very long way to go, unfortunately. And we hear of young people who have gone to their GP or gone to other specialists who have actively discouraged them from talking about it or from seeking help elsewhere. And I can see how that happens, but I just don't feel that it's acceptable.
What happens when a kid gets to 18, 19, 20, has gotten past the stage two stage and changes their mind?
Actually, it's very, very rare
yeah,
for someone to change their
yeah.
mind. Yeah, and it's always one of our concerns, obviously, because we don't ever want to do any harm. And when we start hormone treatment, we tend to be relatively cautious and, as I mentioned, not treating can be harmful too. So
yeah,
that balance between wanting to do the most that we can but without being reckless. And certainly we're not reckless in any way. We do a thorough assessment. But there's a study that's just come out of the Netherlands. So the team at Utrecht University, who've been doing this the longest with
yes.
trans children, adolescents and adults, they've gone back and looked at all the cases that they've provided medical care for from 1977. And the rates of regret are somewhere between 0.4% and 0.6%.
Yeah, there you go.
Really low. If you think about the benefits of treating with reduction in suicide rates that are compared with the rate of regret, you can certainly see why we are taking that affirming approach.
When are the guidelines coming out?
They're currently available on our website.
By do you mean the gender service or
the gender service.
Right.
So if people Google RCH, as in Royal Children's Hospital Gender Service, there's a link to the full standards of care and treatment guidelines
Brilliant.
There. And with the MJA publishing the summary, there will also be a link through that article. I think the guidelines are good for people who don't know a lot about trans children and adolescents, so they're not aimed at subspecialists who are necessarily prescribing hormone treatment. They can be really valuable for people who are just setting out, wanting to know a bit more. We have a clear guide for general practitioners on aspects of care that they can become part of.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly for young people, we like to engage with shared care with general practitioners. And also there are aspects of the guide that provide terminology, provide general instruction on how best to engage and affirm young people when they do disclose their gender identity. So I would encourage people who are just wanting to learn a bit more about it, up to those who would like to know what investigations to do and what to prescribe should they become more confident with it. There's all of that information there, and hopefully that's helpful across various levels, but also across disciplines. There is information in there too for people who are speech pathologists, who are psychologists, doctors, and so forth. Thanks so much, Kate.
Thanks, Michelle. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.